sitting in Mary's.
Nothing bad.
January 29th meeting of the Economic Development Budget Division will come to order. Quorum is present. Today we're going to be going over the governor's budget recommendation, and as far as the Department of Employment and Economic Development is concerned, we have Commissioner McElroy here with us today. Commissioner, you've gone over some things earlier, kind of a summary, and I think we want more of a comprehensive go page by page thing. I'm going to encourage members to ask questions as we go along, so that in case you say something that somebody doesn't understand, that they will be able to ask you about it immediately. Also, you're going to see a lot of numbers in these budget documents that repeat themselves and kind of are somewhat of cross-references to other numbers in the budget document, and so they'll either clear things up for you or they'll confuse things. So one way or another, if you have a question, don't be afraid to ask it. So, Commissioner, go ahead, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The plan for today is, first of all, if you would find this document, I believe it's in your book, Cap tells me, rather than in your document, and it's a 11-page handout. And I'm going to walk through this first, and then I will bring some...
Excuse me, Commissioner. Members, in my book, it's right in front of the deed tab. So if you got a deed tab, there's a braille document at the end of it. You'll see what he's talking about.
Should be a handout that looks like this, and I believe it's in color. I see that Senator Kubley found his.
Oh, we're getting graded?
All right, thank you. You get recognition at least, Senator Metzen. Okay.
Yeah, I think we got it under control now. Okay,
all right.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
The plan is that in this handout, I'm going to explain our principal initiatives. Then we will go through the budget book in some detail, and we'll take your questions kind of at any time. But the purpose of the budget is to achieve the mission of the organization, which is to support the economic success of individuals, businesses, and communities by improving opportunities for growth. And that opportunities, the two words I hear most at this department are partnerships and opportunities. As much of what we accomplish in partnerships with local workforce investment boards, economic development partners, and employers, organized labor, and a variety of others. As I explained in the overview last week, it's easiest to think of the Department of Employment and Economic Development as having three principal divisions or three principal functions. We operate the Business and Community Development Division, which assists communities and companies in providing good jobs. We assist workers and employers through our Workforce Development Division, and we operate the state's Unemployment Insurance Division. The overall budget that you're going to see in this book is a big budget. It's approximately $2.7 billion. That totals our operating expenses, our pass-through grants to others, and payments to individuals exclusively, essentially, in the unemployment insurance business. Of that $2.7 billion, about $1.5 billion is uninsurance benefits that are paid from the federal trust fund, but the money for unemployment insurance benefits comes from Minnesota employers through the unemployment insurance tax they pay. You see in the top bullet there a number of $1.6 billion. That's $1.5 billion in benefits and about $100 million to operate the system and to upgrade our technology as part of a project called the Unemployment Insurance Technology Improvement Plan that you'll sometimes hear us talk about as UITIP, and that's the acronym for Unemployment Insurance Technology Improvement Program. We spend $370 million in other federal funds. Many of those in our workforce programs, some of them that come from the Department of Housing and Urban Development and our Small Cities Economic Development Grants, some of them in our program for veterans. The department gets federal funds from 10 federal agencies, and ranging from the Department of Labor for our Workforce Investment Act and Wagner-Peisner activities, from the Department of Education for our vocational rehabilitation services, from, as I mentioned, HUD for Small Cities Community Economic Development Grants, and from a variety of others. We spend $560 million in Public Facilities Authority funds. The PFA operates the Drinking Water Revolving Fund, the the Wastewater Infrastructure Fund, and a number of other revolving loan funds for community infrastructure. We have $112 million in special revenue funds, including the Workforce Development Fund, the Petroleum Tank Release Fund, and repayments from existing loan programs and some others. And then this budget calls for $96 million from the general fund. That's an increase of $21 million from the current biennium 06-07, and it's that $21 million that principally represents the initiatives I'll be talking about in a moment. If you turn to the next page, we represented how we spend the taxpayers' money in two pie charts. The one on the left is the all funds chart. It's very honestly a little misleading when we will be asking you to appropriate money from federal funds, special revenue funds, and the general fund, because as you can see, the largest pieces of that are the Unemployment Insurance Fund, which is a statutory appropriation from the federal trust fund, and the PFA, which is a bonded program that's also a statutory authorization. If you look to the right, that pie fund is, or pie chart, is how DEED spends your money without the Public Facilities Authority and unemployment insurance. Business and Community Development is $104 million. The Workforce Development Program is $461 million. And our administration of these funds is about $10 million, or less than 1% of our total budget. The next slide shows where the money comes from. $95 million, as I said, or almost $96 million from the general fund, the Workforce Development Fund of $81 million, federal funds of $470 million, and the PFA of $560 million. This particular pie chart does not include unemployment insurance, which is $1.6 billion. The next
Commissioner is I think in the past we've been moving money from the Workforce Development Fund to other areas. Are we doing that again in this budget?
There are, Mr. Chairman, there are some appropriations that are in our base from the Workforce Development Fund. There are no transfers that I'm aware of from the Workforce Development Fund to other funds. Is that correct, John? That's correct. And we can provide a history in the Carlson administration and perhaps in the early Ventura administration, there were some transfers from the Workforce Development Fund to the general fund. We are not recommending, that's not part of the governor's budget. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't part of the governor's budget in his first administration either. Even when we had a tough budget deficit, we did not recommend transfers from the Workforce Development Fund. The legislature for the 07 or 06-07 biennial budget did directly appropriate some for some programs that they felt were of a workforce development nature. Does that answer your question?
So
all right. Page six is our statewide locations, and I have to tell you that we're missing one. There is a small DEED office in Roseau that does not show on this four-person office that doesn't show on the map. But the balance of these are workforce centers and our business development regional offices and our small business development centers. I said when I did the general overview of the agency that we serve the entire state. I hope this map makes that clear. Our workforce services serve people in all 87 counties. Our business and community development services serve most counties. Some counties have more projects than others. The change items in the governor's budget or the initiatives for 2008-2009 focus on strategic investments. Some of them are one-time recommendations, $10 million to recapitalize important development programs, and you'll hear these again as we go through each of our divisions. But that is $7 million to the Minnesota Investment Fund, $2 million to the Redevelopment Fund, and $1 million to the Urban Enterprise Fund. We're recommending a $1 million appropriation for the Biobusiness Alliance to assist in continuing to develop a strategic plan for Minnesota to be a major player in the biobusiness industry. $250,000 to University Enterprise Laboratories, a major innovation incubator. $200,000 to the Department for additional marketing of Minnesota's, our Positively Minnesota marketing initiatives. And $192,000 of state general fund money to reimburse the Unemployment Insurance Fund for state-related entities that are now gone or out of business. Some of it is for charter schools, and some of it is for the Ombudsman for Corrections that have essentially gone out of existence owing money to the unemployment fund. And rather than penalize the balance in the fund, we're asking to reimburse that out of the general fund, and that's $192,000 one time. Also, in the next page, page 8, these are initiatives that are in our base. And $5 million is increases in base for vocational rehabilitation and state services for the blind to maximize federal resources. There have been some increases in these funds in the federal budget, and we have a what's called a maintenance of effort requirement. We have to keep up our share of the deal, but these state dollars return federal dollars at $3.70 of federal money to each dollar of state money. And so it is, we need the money to continue to provide services to our population and to those who need services. If we don't provide this money to match federal money, there's a danger we'll have to go on waiting lists for many of our services, something that's technically called an order of selection. But it's also, I think, a great opportunity to maximize the federal resources that come back to Minnesota, and it's in the governor's budget. $1.8 million to increase the base for extended employment. $1 million for a new program that will be explained in a few minutes called the Career Guide Program for Youth, and it's a program to increase career counseling available to young Minnesotans. $871,000 is a compensation analysis adjustment recommended in the governor's budget and additional funding for our labor market analysis program, and $200,000 for small community technical assistance through the Public Facilities Authority to assist very small communities that are the subject of TMDLs to plan to address their clean water challenges, and we'll provide that help through the Public Facilities Authority.
Commissioner, when you say real small communities, is there a population number on that, or is there...
As we get further into the presentation, we have a sample list, but they tend to be communities, where's Terry, under 500?
Anywhere from 5 to 30 households.
Real small. Okay.
So probably under 100 population. Okay. Also included in the budget are general fund pass-through funding that's in our base, and it's in the governor's budget. You're certainly welcome to question all of these. You could not fund these if you chose to, but these are in our base. And they're listed on page 9. Those come from the general fund. And then on page 10 are the ones that come from the Workforce Development Fund. And Senator, or Mr. Chairman, this essentially answers your question. These are the appropriations that were in the Workforce Development Fund base that are not, the Workforce Development Fund is intended to pay for the Dislocated Workers Program, the Job Skills Partnership. These are things that the legislature took out of that base. Some of them have been funded from the Workforce Development Fund for a few years now. All right, that is, and if after you look back at this, or as we go along, if you have other questions, we simply provided the deed website, positivelyminnesota.com, so that you can get more information as we go along. I now want to bring up the first of our program leaders to start explaining the budget. But let me, now I want to turn you to the budget book itself and the area after the deed tab.
Senator Parasol has a question.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I have a question for you about pages 9 and 10. You have these different programs on through the pass-through base funding. I think it was this morning's paper. I don't know which day I read it because I came back from a trip and I had about 6 newspapers, so I read them all at one time, one day. They had an article that I clipped out that had to do with, it says the state may hire, no, the state, how, the state may have a program to make jobs to give to the, to I think the people who are on welfare programs, or I don't, it's for youth and welfare programs. Would that come through any of these listed on page 8 and 9?
I don't believe so. I believe
that they would
that
create jobs just
is
for the
a human services proposal through MFIP. Is that, does anybody know? It isn't our program, so I believe it.
All right. Okay, thank you.
All right. If I can then turn your attention to the budget book. And CAP suggested that I just take a minute to explain how the budget book is organized, because I believe this is the first budget you've gone through in this session, and hopefully they're all organized the same way. Ours is certainly, we hope to be consistent. The senator's right that sometimes the numbers can be a little confusing because they tend to repeat things. But it starts on page 1 and 2 with a table of contents. page three, or I'm sorry, page four, starts on page, then page three is a cover letter, which essentially covers some of the introduction I did last week. Page four and five is an agency profile. We're not going to go through that in detail, but it explains what the agency does if you hadn't attended the overview last week.
Commissioner, before you go on, is this something to do with Braille?
It is, and it's a sample we asked to be put in that will go with Chuck Hamilton's explanation of what the Community Center for the Blind does. We do a huge amount of that work for K-12 education or throughout the state, and we provided it to your staff, and they put it at the front. Chuck will be referring to that when he explains the Communication Center for the Blind.
Okay.
But there aren't a whole lot of places in Minnesota that can do that kind of work, and that's an example of a Braille map from an elementary school textbook. Page six is the numbers part of the agency overview. If you look at the bottom right-hand corner, you'll see that number, $1,241,153. That's the $1,200,000,000 approximately that I referred to as our budget prior to unemployment comp. You add unemployment comp and you get to that $2,007,000,000 number that I mentioned. We then, on page seven, have a change summary that is the numeric explanation of the change items that I mentioned in the color handout. And we will explain each of those again as we go through the program explanations, which we'll do in just a minute. Starting on page nine is our program. So that section is called the agency overview. We are now going to follow, I believe we have a total of 20 approximately program explanations. I'm going to bring up the leaders from our various divisions to explain those programs to you. Their sections include a program description in the first page, a numbers page that gives you their overall numbers, and then business and community development and explanation of each of their programs. So we're going to start with Mark Loftus, Director of Business Development, and Mark is going to explain pages 9 through 29.
Welcome, Mr. Loftus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Loftus. I am Director of Business Development in the department, and specifically in the Business and Community Development Division, which I'll refer to today for simplicity as BCD, which is how we reference it as a division. Before I go into the budget narrative pages and change requests, I thought it would be useful to summarize the broad categories of our work so that we have the framework and the context of our activities. And there are really two broad categories, as the name would suggest, both business assistance and community development, community infrastructure, community revitalization, a whole category of community activities. First category of assisting businesses covers everything from very small businesses and entrepreneurs up to larger companies. We provide what we hope is superior information, assistance, and coordination of resources to help them grow and start in Minnesota. And in that whole category of activities includes a lot of programs that you probably will recognize by name. They would include things like the Small Business Assistance Office, Small Business Development Centers as part of that. We have exporting help through the Minnesota Trade Office. We have business development specialists who package resources for expansion of companies. As the commissioner said, we have the Urban Initiative Program that focuses on small business lending in the metro area. We administer pass-through grants to groups like MITA and Women Venture. We support the small business innovation research activities, which helps companies acquire federal funds to help them commercialize new technologies and bring them into the marketplace. We administer the Rural Job Z Program. We engage in state support for biosciences. We are involved in gap financing and incentives for the Minnesota Investment Fund, and we also work on promoting Minnesota's great economy for further investment. So business assistance is one whole side of our division. The other half, and certainly where most of the large financial programs are, is the community infrastructure area. and the strategic investments that we place in infrastructure occur through a lot of different things. And when we talk about community infrastructure, we mean everything from water systems to wastewater treatment, housing in a variety of ways, commercial buildings. We're talking about public infrastructure like roads and sidewalks and curb and gutter in some cases. We're talking about cleanup of contaminated land for development. And we're talking about removal of dilapidated buildings so that more development can occur. And so why are all those things important? Well, obviously, without safe and affordable and physically workable infrastructure, we can't have investment and job creation. And the state's involved, of course, because infrastructure is expensive, cannot be afforded easily in all parts of the state, and because state funds can help leverage more investment. And virtually all of our programs require some kind of match, often from private, but sometimes from public sources, nevertheless helping leverage more money than the state provides. So when we talk about community infrastructure, we're talking about several programs, the Contamination Cleanup Program, Redevelopment Program, Small Cities Program, and also the Public Facilities Authority, which is headed by Terry Coleman, who is here today also. And with that $560 million amount for the whole biennium, representing close to half of the non-unemployment insurance funds within the department. So Terry is here to answer questions that you have about those programs of the Public Facilities Authority. So with that as a background, I ask you to turn to page 11 in your budget books. This is the narrative that begins to talk about the Office of Business Development, where our staff work to assist companies in growing in Minnesota. Now, and when they do that, they don't necessarily have a single program that they administer. Instead, they're drawing upon all the resources of our department, including resources outside the department, to help companies grow. And I just want to give you a very quick example of a project we worked on this last fall that illustrates the point of how our department can work on business expansion. Some of you are probably aware, in the last fall in Redwood Falls in southwest Minnesota, there was a company by the name of Artisan Technologies that's owned by Emerson Electric out in St. Louis. They announced during the fall that they'd be closing the operation and would be laying off about 230 people and selling the facility, which is the largest private employer in Redwood Falls, a town of about 5,000. Well, at the same time, the city was scratching their heads as to what they might do to fill that gap. They discovered that there's a company in South Dakota by the name of Daktronics that was in the process of looking for an expansion location. They contacted the company, and there's a very long story that we don't have time for today, but between the efforts of the city and the people in the region and the people at the state level, we were able to convince Daktronics to acquire that facility in Redwood Falls and hire at least 150 people. There's also another business in the Redwood Falls area that's going to be employing some more of the people that would otherwise have been laid off. So we applied a lot of programs in that area, in that particular project, the Jobs Z program, the Job Skills Partnership, labor market information, our own research and marketing skills, workforce services, all to the point to convince Daktronics to expand in Minnesota. And we're talking about a South Dakota company expanding in Minnesota, which is, it's the old dog bites man or man bites dog story.
Hauling coal to Newcastle. That's our second or third Job Z move businesses from South Dakota to Minnesota success. Total Card was that. I'm not sure if there's another.
There was another meat processing company, too. Right. But for us, that kind of unusual story just doesn't happen every day. But it is the kind of thing that really, this was a company that was laying off people at Christmas time, basically. And we're able to help those people keep a job. These are household-supporting positions, the kind of thing that really, it doesn't get much better than that for us, and the kind of thing that helps us get up to work and come to work every day. So,
good job. Mr. Loftus, yeah. Are you planning on going down the budget sheet here on page 10 also? The reason I'm asking that is because I think members should know what's one-time, what's base, and what's different. From last year to this year, and yeah, I don't think you have to go in real in depth, or you should be able to do it quickly. But I think a little bit of an explanation of these numbers might be something that committee members should hear.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you look at the top of the page, and I would probably ask John Stavros to help with this if you're looking.
John, would you come up?
Because some of these funds consolidate various requests. But if I can maybe turn to the governor's recommendations as the one time at the top. If you look in the, it's in the second box. There are several, and I'll summarize these as we go through them on the one-time change requests.
Before we do that, I'd like, John, to take, there's an item that says technical adjustment, one-time appropriations, and it's negative numbers. And just so people know what that is, and you don't have to give the list, but just explain what that means kind of in general.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Stavros. I'm the CFO at Deed. As Commissioner mentioned, that number, those numbers are adjustments required to get our last year's budget to what the legislated base is. And in the case of the negative $27 million, those are all legislative appropriations made one time. And so we have to back them out of our base. For instance, last session there was a $15 million appropriation to the university for biotech, and that was one time. So part of that $27 million is the $15 million being subtracted out of the budget to meet legislative intent.
So somebody asked me, why is the governor recommending cutting economic development by $54,868,000? That's not the case. The legislature established the base as part of the 06-07 budget, and we're adding back from the 06-07 base. So, Mark, why don't you go ahead then with the governor's recs, our one-timers.
The Biobusiness Alliance is $1 million for the biennium, $500,000 per year to support the activities of that alliance, which is a non-state program, a private entity that helps support the governor's bioscience initiative that we've been working on for several years. But it would help them complete their assessment of the bioscience industry that they've begun this year, and also help in the development of their biobusiness resource network that will help companies directly. University Enterprise Laboratories is in a $250,000 recommendation. That's a one-time support for some of the fledgling enterprises that would go into the University Enterprise Laboratory facility off of University and 280, who otherwise could not afford the rents that the UEL has to charge. So it wouldn't be subsidizing all the businesses in there, but some of those that are maybe more or at least start up and need some extra assistance. Now, the Minnesota Investment Fund is requesting has a request for $7 million one time again. This is our program that helps companies with primarily low-interest financing and in some cases forgivable loans to assist with the capital expenditure costs of an expansion that's creating quality jobs. Currently, we have no general fund appropriation. We are operating off of loan repayments from past loans and currently have a pipeline of probably $4 to $5 million of projects that we will be funding off of federal monies that we have from our economic development set aside from federal block grant funds, but also past state loan repayments. So we're asking for one-time $7 million there. Redevelopment grants, one-time for $2 million. That is a support to the program that helps remove dilapidated structures. We have had in the past bonding money for that purpose, and in those cases we could only invest in those monies in publicly owned infrastructure. This would give us a little more flexibility as a general fund appropriation to either infrastructure or removal of facilities on private property. The Small Community Technical Assistance, $200,000, as the commissioner said, represents those very small communities or unincorporated areas that have a serious threat to health and safety and evaluate solutions for those water or wastewater treatment problems. Urban Initiative is requesting $1 million. We have currently loan repayments that are being used in that program. It's been in business since 1994 and have made about 664 loans. This is a program that aims at the Twin Cities metropolitan area and works through 10 neighborhood and nonprofit community partners to make loans for small businesses and startup entrepreneurs in Minneapolis and St. Paul primarily, but also a couple of suburbs. And compensation adjustment, I guess, Commissioner, you or John could speak to that.
It's a recommendation by the governor to have some allowance for increased compensation as part of our contract negotiations with state employees that takes place this year. And it's consistent across all the agencies of government. It's about 2% per year of our current general fund compensation. And if we move on expenditures by fund, this is a roll-up or an accumulation of what you'll see in the program pages that follow, Senator. And so if it would be okay, I'd like to have them move ahead to the program pages, and then it will add up to this, but we can come back to it if we need to.
That works.
But if I can let Mark go ahead to starting on page 11, if you'll look on page, I think it's 14 will be the numbers that go with the narrative that starts on page 11. He had briefly started to take you through that narrative. He'll explain the numbers on 14.
That works.
If we could look at the, well, we have change requests in there for that. Maybe you should go to expenditures by fund.
On page 14?
On page 14, yes.
I do need to make one correction before we do that. There is a typo, and with all the proofreading we do, I have to acknowledge at the bottom of page 12, it says that we spent 137,000 hours with customers in the small business development centers. We don't have that many people. It should have been 37,585. So if you just cross out that extra one, you'll notice that's consistent with the 36,000 hours we spent with people last year. That's 18 people years, so that's a lot of time, but there is a typo there. We got an extra one in addition to the parentheses. All right, now to page 14 in expenditures by fund.
Mr. Chairman, I might ask John Stavros to, if he has the breakdown of these components of each of these categories. You have,
Mr. Chair. Yes, the one-time appropriations minus number that you see is made up of three different programs that were funded one time by the legislature. The largest, the one I mentioned earlier, University of Minnesota Biotech, for $15 million. One is the 21st Century Minerals Fund, a one-time appropriation of $11,500,000. And
each year?
One time.
All right.
And the last part of it is $467,000 for the Biobusiness Alliance. That was a one-time appropriation. Those three make up the $26,967,000.
As far as the expenditures by fund?
Well, the expenditures for this program are $7.5 million from the general fund, principally pays salaries and other indirect expenses. And you can see total compensation for this is $3.9 million, other operating expenses $1.6 million, and local assistance of $5.2 million. Balancing with that total resources, which came from the general fund, miscellaneous special revenue, and federal funds, and a gift of $119,000, so that the program took in $10.79 million and expended $10.79 million. The program then is the business development enterprises. Can we go on to the next one is the change item for Biobusiness and Alliance, Mark.
Okay. That is on page 15, Mr. Chairman. The $1 million over the biennium to support their Biobusiness Alliance's activities. Our staff work closely with them. We have a specialist on our staff by the name of Kevin McKinnon, who works with the Biobusiness Alliance and Life Sciences Alley in the administration of the efforts to support bioscience development. So there is a close connection between DEED and these non-state entities.
And this has to be matched, I see.
Yes, matched with private dollars.
Non-state dollars.
State.
And then you can go on to 16.
16 is good.
Mr. Chairman, page 16 covers the $250,000 for the University Enterprise Laboratories. That is a, it's in effect a subsidy for those small companies that couldn't otherwise afford the rents that they charge there. I've been told that the rents that are charged are probably in the range of 25% over market rates. And I have, I don't know the full answer for that, but I make a good guess that that's probably because it's a new facility that has additional laboratory costs It's hard to gauge exactly what the market rate is for those kinds of wet lab costs and related expenses.
This is like an incubator, right?
That's correct.
Yes.
Okay.
You will see a bill. They had been hoping to get a lot more than this. But the governor did think that they needed some help, but not as much as they had hoped for. We expect that you'll see a bill for somewhere between $3 and $5 million of support.
They asked for a million. Do we do this often? Supplement business who is charging too much?
We would see it as subsidizing the high-tech tenants who are trying to develop ideas that will result in future high-tech companies that will have jobs in Minnesota.
Is there a payback? I mean, are they going to pay this money back, or is this a grant?
This is a grant. This is not a loan.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, you turn to page 17 is where we would probably characterize all the financial heavy lifting of our division is summarized. And I would call your attention to several in that area services provided at the bottom half of the page. The contamination cleanup program is the assistance for cleaning up soil and groundwater contamination. This program has been in business for a number of years, and staff have identified a couple of projects that we certainly have them all across the state, but they're areas that are many of you would be familiar with, such as the St. Paul, South St. Paul Armor site, the investigation grant at Farmland Foods when they burned down that facility, burned down at Albert Lea, the site that became the quarry in northeast Minneapolis, and also the Elm Park dump in Farmington, among a number of projects across the state. But that is one of our main infrastructure programs. Also, the redevelopment program, we're asking for, as we've said, $2 million to local governments to acquire and make sites ready for further development, including projects. That's one that's underway in Virginia, Mr. Chairman, the Horace Mann redevelopment project. Also, projects like the Chase Hotel project in Walker, the downtown elevator in Maple Lake, and the hospital site in Tyler, among others that we've done. And also the Small Cities Development Program, roughly $18 million a year that we get from the federal government and use that to make grants to small cities across the state. And I think as we talk about the effect of our department's program here in rural Minnesota, it would be hard to find an area of the state that was not covered by or not affected by a small cities development project. We've done everything from housing rehabilitation to multifamily units to commercial and downtown renovation projects, public facilities, sewers and sidewalks and curbs and lighting and downtown renovation. You'd see this across Minnesota. And I have a long list of all the projects that we've done across the state. It's been in business for at least 20 years now, and is one of our most sought-after programs. We also use a portion of those monies for our business loan programs as well, Mr. Chairman. And I would say also that we can only use those federal funds in areas that are not entitlement areas. For instance, most of the Twin Cities gets money directly from the federal government for this program, and some other larger metros like St. Cloud, Moorhead, Duluth, and Rochester. Also, St. Louis County has funds directly from the federal government so we cannot use these small city funds directly in a place like St. Louis County. So that's why in many cases we need state money to be able to make the same kind of investments that we in a St. Louis County or a St. Cloud, because we can't use the federal money there. The other points that I would refer you to on page 17, the Minnesota
Is that a population thing?
It's based on population size. Yeah, yes.
And it's from the feds that they don't allow you to do it, or do we have a...
I believe, Mr. Chairman, that those counties or those areas have opted out of the program and have said they want the funds directly from the federal government. So
those counties which have chosen or qualified to be what are called entitlement grant counties are not eligible for the small cities program because they get money themselves from from HUD for what they call it CDBG, Community Development Block Grant Programs. If you're not eligible for CDBG funds, then you are eligible for the small cities development grants.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'd refer you to the bullet points at the bottom of page 17, referencing the Minnesota Investment Fund. As I said, we're living off past loan repayments from earlier state loans that are being repaid, and some of our federal monies. This is to help us invest in companies that are trying to buy equipment or expand their facilities in the process of creating jobs, and that is one of our change requests. Also, Urban Initiative Program, a very popular program with 646 loans since 1994 in the Twin Cities area. 10 partners that we work with is there as well. On page 18, if you turn to that page, you'll see a summary of the Public Facilities Authority program. I would ask Mr. Coleman to come to the table if there are questions about all of these programs. The one change request does relate to his program that talks about the small community technical assistance grants for very small communities.
But the programs from sort of the second paragraph down are all Public Facilities Authority programs. They'll spend about $560 million during the biennium. That money comes from a combination of bond funds, some federal money, and a lot of repayment of loans. And it is a very important program to areas that need to update sewage treatment plans, that may have revolving loan freshwater programs, that may participate in the methamphetamine laboratory cleanup fund. It's a very important program, and one the legislature has been very supportive of over the years. If anybody has questions about that, we can bring Terry Coleman up.
Is anybody on the committee want Mr. Coleman to come and explain this, or would you rather have a private meeting with him in your office?
He's available. All right. Let's.
Commissioner, before we get off of this, I sometimes the press's timing is incredible. There was an article today about Job Z, and I think I'm trying to get a copy of it here in the Star Tribune today about whether or not these companies would have actually expanded with or without Job Z, and whether or not Job Z was actually the reason for it. And it was in some cases it looked like Job Z was the reason, in some cases it looked like it would have happened regardless. How much of these numbers are we taking credit for that really isn't the effect of Job Z? Do we know that, or is that hypothetical?
I don't believe we've taken credit any place in here for Job Z. Job Z is principally under the purview of the Tax Committee. And Job Z is, there isn't any state general fund money that goes to it.
But there's some numbers in here that, 252 business deals resulting in 8,000 retained jobs and 3,800.
Coming up on the next.
That I'm reading off of page 17.
Page where is
page 19?
Activity.
19. And I just have to ask Mark if that includes Job Z deals.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it does.
I got it.
When I say that we have the responsibility for the administration of Job Z in our department, we are the home of the collection of the original plans that were approved, the allocation of the zones. We receive the business subsidy agreements that our communities develop. It's decentralized in that sense that they execute those agreements under the state law and the program. We collect them. We collect the data. We are at the point now where we're going to be working with revenue to evaluate the first group of loans that have been made with their two-year history and determine where there may be issues with compliance with the business subsidy agreements. The question of whether we are taking credit for the work of all these Job Z projects and whether they would have happened absent Job Z, Mr. Chairman, we are not. These are the results that come from the local community's execution of agreements. I guess that's about the best I can say there. We are very proud of having the Job Z program. But as the Commissioner said, there are proposals that will be in the Tax Committee that will discuss the
and how the law goes forward. Yeah. But the Star Tribune reporter, Pat Doyle, spent about 3 weeks on that story, called a lot of Job Z companies. He found one that said, we were going to do this anyway. We have talked to literally dozens, maybe hundreds, that have said we couldn't have done it but for this. New Ulm AMPI is going to write all of you a letter saying we would be in Iowa if not for Job Z. We know Daktronics wouldn't have come to Redwood Falls but for Job Z. The total card wouldn't be in Jackson, but for Job Z, or where's Total Card? Jackson?
Laverne.
Laverne. We think the majority of them wouldn't have been there, but there are certainly a few that might have been. I don't know that we'll ever design a perfect project.
Senator Saxhawk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My comment would be that I've been in sales all my life, and the Job Z program was a reason to talk to business. Sometimes it's not the actual reason for keeping it there, but it's something to talk about when you're talking with people expanding or trying to get people to come to your area. So I consider it a tool
in the
successful
toolbox.
Tool.
Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing that was brought to our attention by one of the cities I represent is, are these, when you do these jobs, these, are they transferable to other companies or once they're actually in place?
So, for example, if the ABC company did a deal in the Wyoming Business Park and got Job Z, mm-hmm. and then sold the business to the XYZ company, do the benefits carry forward? Is that kind of what you're asking?
Mr. Chair, no. Well, not exactly. If the ABC company decided not to do whatever it is they were going to do originally, and a different company was to take their place prior to.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the answer to that is no. The business subsidy agreement is executed with a specific company. It has to be in that parcel of land where Job Z status has been provided by the city and by the local government and by the state. But they can't transfer. No. They are signing that business subsidy agreement with a commitment to job creation and investment at some level. So transference, no.
Mr. Chair, to your knowledge, none of these haven't been transferred. Would you be the agency that would know?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, we are. If it's happened and we don't know about it, if you know of a circumstance that it may have been said to have happened, I'd certainly like to follow up if we can.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I have two questions. One is, do you know the average wage for the employees in the jobs that were created, if you could give us that information? And then the second question I have is whether anyone has looked at whether there have been any jobs displaced by these businesses coming into an area, and if that's one of the considerations when you decide whether to grant a Job Z funding, whether it's going to have an impact on other existing businesses that are already there, or how that's measured, if it is.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, first of all, are you asking about wages specifically from Job Z projects?
Mr. Chair, yes, I am.
All right. I believe the last number I saw was $14.99 per hour average. In terms of displacement, Mark, can you address that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, we don't conduct, nor do we expect the local government to conduct an evaluation of whether another business might be affected by a company growing or receiving assistance. It's not an evaluation that they're required to do. It's as a competitive economy, companies are growing and changing and ebbing and flowing all the time. So it's not a specific evaluation that we conduct. No, short answer.
Senator Olson, in the article, it says that the minimum they can pay is $10.23 to $10.58 an hour. But they think the average is $14.86. I think there was a number in here of the amount the state is going to lose over the years that this is in place. Was it $100 million that I saw in tax collections? Is that what I saw in here somewhere?
It's on the first page.
Joining me is Paul Moe, who has been heavily involved as deputy commissioner of the agency.
Mr. Chairman, members, Paul Moe from the department. The $14.99 per hour wage level that the commissioner referred to earlier was the actual wages paid for projects that entered agreements in 2004 and 2005. What happens is a company will enter into business subsidy agreement and establish a wage goal. And sometimes that will be, let me back up. In 2005, the legislation was strengthened to put a wage threshold in the law. The first year of the program did not. So as of now, as of 2005, those companies qualifying for Jobs E-benefits have to agree to $10.58 an hour. And that number goes up every year. There's a price escalator that we measure against the federal poverty level for a family of four that goes up every July. So in 2004 and 5, those 100 and some businesses entered agreements, and the result of those projects have created some 3,600 jobs that pay $14.99 an hour. And that number will be updated as the 2006 projects are evaluated, and those reports come in as well.
We expect to have 2006 numbers in sometime in February or perhaps early March.
I'm sorry. Mark, did you mention the $100 million, Mr. Moe? Because I was just being whispered in.
Mr. Chairman, the number that was depicted in the paper, I think it was $100 million, which is an estimate from someone at the Department of Revenue that says over the life of the program, the tax exemptions value might be as much as $100 million. We have numbers from working with the Department of Revenue for 2004 that tax exemption value or credit, if you will, was or benefit, tax benefit, was some $6.1 million. That's roughly $12 million for 2005. And again, that's a number that's evaluated every year as we get the reports in, as we work with Department of Revenue, as the tax returns come in.
Now, as part of the Job Z program, you have to promise to create a certain number of new jobs, right? You just can't have the Job Z benefit because you want it, right?
Mr. Chairman, each business subsidy agreement is negotiated between the local unit of government and the business that identifies the job and wage goals. There are provisions now in the law that say for relocations there has to be at least 5 new jobs, and there also is a wage threshold for all projects.
Okay. I'm being told that the buzzing that is happening on the PA system here is from BlackBerries that are turned on in the room. And so if you have BlackBerries in your pocket that are turned on, I think we need to turn them off so it doesn't buzz. So you don't have to act right away like you're guilty, but you know, wait a little while before you reach your partner or something. So anyway, okay. Any other questions, Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, so if we were to break it down just in terms of the numbers of how much we're spending in terms of tax credits per year versus how many jobs were created, I just don't have my calculator handy to be able to make that calculation. How much per job are we spending to support in tax dollars to support each one of these jobs?
Paul Moe has been running this program, so I'm going to ask Paul to answer that for you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I don't have that off the top of my head, but I'm happy to provide that for you to give that breakdown.
Well, would it simply, Mr. Chair, would it simply be a matter of determining how many new jobs, and we know there, how many we have, how many new jobs we've created through this program?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the 2004 and 2005 projects, there were some 3,600 jobs.
3,600 jobs?
Correct.
And we're spending $10 million per year in tax credits for those 3,600 jobs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it was $6 million for 2004 and some $12 million for 2005.
Do the math. Okay. Were the number of jobs the new jobs, or was that the total number of jobs?
Mr. Chairman, that was new jobs.
Okay.
In addition to that, we had job retention during those 2 years of about 5,600 jobs. The total of new jobs and retention is almost 10,000 jobs. Now, retention
is neither here nor there.
Yeah, retention, does it mean retention in Minnesota or retention in a community? And it's a harder number. The new jobs are, so that means we spent maybe $2,500 a job. Other states that are paying cash are spending, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars a job for large auto plants and big tire factories and things like that. this isn't cheap, but it isn't as expensive as a lot of our competitors are spending to attract and keep good-paying jobs.
Senator Vandergriff.
Well, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, earlier I think you said that you didn't know if you were displacing jobs when a Jobs E came in from competitors. So then how do you know if you look at retention and you look at new, then how do you come up with your number?
What Mark Loft has said is we don't require a detailed workforce study, for example, saying that if industrial rubber in Hibbing created 20 jobs recently, that those people may have been able to get jobs somewhere else. We don't do a detailed study that if a company moves from one community 50 miles or 30 miles or 40 miles, a detailed econometric analysis. We're giving the best information we have based on what communities are required to report under the law and the information that we get from various sources. Okay. In order to stay on schedule, I'd like to be
questions.
Able to
We don't keep... really have a schedule, but go ahead.
Well, the schedule we were given by your committee is that we need to get through our budget by the end of your hearing today, and so we'd like to do that.
That's right.
All right.
Okay.
Mark.
Mr. Chairman, on page 19, there are tables that describe some of the programs, some of the outcome measures that we have for most of our infrastructure types of programs. And then on page 21 is the summary of the budget activities. If you look at our budget in this area, about $6.3 million over the biennium, largely a combination of staff costs primarily within our division. The bottom half at the expenditures by fund is where the bulk of the Public Facilities Authority money comes, but also there are pieces in there like the repayments from existing Minnesota Investment Fund loans that we are also able to use, and it would take further analysis by John Stavros probably to describe how each line item there is broken out from which particular program. But total expenditures over the biennium, $650 million. On pages 22 through 26 are the change item requests that we've already begun to talk about. The contamination, I guess, one we haven't discussed too much, the contamination tax on page 22, which is currently going to the general fund, but we're suggesting that it be available to support the contamination cleanup grant program itself to complement the existing operation of the program, which is about $1.4 million from general fund monies and $6.2 million in petroleum tank cleanup funds. So that would direct those funds right into the grant program, which we administer.
Was the money going there anyway? It was just going through the general fund first?
No, this would redirect. It's in the governor's budget. And we think the tax committee may also have a view on this issue. The Department of Finance essentially would be giving this up from the indicated, and the governor's recommending that we redirect it from the general fund to the contamination cleanup fund. So in a sense, that's why it's in your budget, not in the tax budget. It doesn't change the tax. It changes where the tax goes. And so we're asking you to appropriate this money from the general fund to the contamination fund, and what it does is capture the contamination tax.
So was it good that the finance chair left before we talked about this, or was it?
I didn't know the finance commissioner was here.
The chair. No, it's okay. You don't have to answer that one. Okay, go ahead.
And I think you can go on to 23.
Page 23 is the Minnesota Investment Fund that we've talked about. One-time $7 million infusion of funds so that we can make loans to businesses across the state. We have a good track record of working with companies in all parts of Minnesota with this Minnesota Investment Fund, again, primarily low-interest loan programs that are all matched by private sources and in many cases matched multiple times over in our administration.
This would ultimately turn into a revolving loan fund?
It is turning into a revolving loan fund now.
Right.
And we're reinvesting, reloaning the repayments.
Mr. Chairman, page 24 discusses the redevelopment program that we've already talked about in some ways, but a good way to take care of a cost of cleaning up a site, removing a building or facility that needs to be taken out of a part of a community so that more development can move forward. And in the past, we've had both general fund and bond dollars used for this program. This is obviously a general fund request.
Okay. Any questions on that?
On page 25 is another area we've talked about, this helping small communities evaluate their failing septic systems.
And Mr. Chairman, I believe we provided an exhibit that is in your packets, and I'm not sure if it's in the book or in the folders, that's a list of communities that are eligible for these funds. Perhaps Mr. O'Rourke can tell us. It's a color page, but it's a long list of very small communities.
Yeah, it's in there.
That would be in the budget book at the end of the original documents prior to the Braille map.
Right behind the next tab, there should be a page that lists the communities, and these are really small communities. But it's a page with yellow highlights on it just before the next tab, I believe. If it's not there, we'll try and find copies of it.
There are two pages, members. One is titled Potential Candidates for Small Community Technical Assistance Grants. And the other one is that. It should be right before the Braille map in your books, the last two pages.
Oh, so they're at the front of the map.
Yeah, they're in front of the map.
I'm sorry. So they're right next to the Braille map.
Is this?
Okay. They're in front of the handout. I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Okay.
That gives you an example of the kinds of communities, and these are communities, as Terry Coleman said, with from 5 to 30 households, but that are obligated. Did you find the handout? All right. And the other page in that same area is the communities that have benefited from urban initiative loans. And they're heavily Minneapolis and St. Paul, but also communities like Hopkins, St. Louis Park, Columbia Heights.
And Mr. Chairman, the change request for urban initiative is on page 26. If we were allocated these funds, we would go through a grant process with the 10 neighborhood community and nonprofit partners to allocate these funds for more loans. But
this is a million extra.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
This is essentially a million in capital. They haven't received capital from the state for many years. They've been working only with repayments, and the demand increases. There was an item in the paper about a grant to the Hopkins Halal Market. They're small, but they have great leverage for jobs.
And according to your other handout in front of the Braille, there's about $11 million in the program already?
There's been $11 million in loans since its beginning. Some of them have been repaid. So they don't have $11 million in capital. But I think if Paul Moe could come up, how much capital have they received over the years, Paul, do you remember?
Six million?
Yes. They've received $6 million in capital. They have, and this is a recycling. That $11 million in loans has been a recycling of that $6 million. They're now at a point where most of their money is out, except for some repayments. And we sincerely believe this is a great program, so we're asking to put another $1 million in capital into their fund.
Are there some rural initiative programs similar to this?
Absolutely. The Minnesota Investment Fund goes heavily to rural Minnesota. The Small Communities Development Grants are only to Greater Minnesota, $18 million a year. Much more of the work in community development is done in Greater Minnesota. This is one of the few programs. In fact, it's the only program I think we have that's targeted.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could add to that, historically, the Minnesota Initiative Funds that were set up by the McKnight Foundation, like the Northland Foundation up in your area, had received money under what was called the Challenge Grant Program. And those were, in fact, grants to them to be made as business loans. Those are also recycling. That money, I believe, is all out in those regions recycling now. But actually, the Urban Initiative Program was created and got their funding at an additional infusion of the Rural Challenge Grant Program time as well. So there is a rural and urban connection between these things.
So it's more accurate to say it's the counterpart of the six rural initiative funds. When those were capitalized, the legislature also capitalized this one. And these are the loans are actually made by not-for-profit partners of ours.
I'm not asking you to defend them. I'm just asking explanations. That's all. So.
It's in my nature to be to defend the program.
You're just a Rookavina, that's all.
If we can move on to page 27, Mark will explain the programs of the trade office.
Yes, we have trade office work is largely in staff costs and personnel related costs. International trade is well documented as a source of economic prosperity and opportunity for companies that export, both manufacturers and service providers too. Even companies like architectural firms and law firms are considered exporters. 80% of our exports in Minnesota are in manufacturing. So our staff help companies with assessing market potential. They do help them with the technical process of exporting. They help them navigate through how they are supposed to go about becoming an exporter. So they put on educational seminars. They are involved in trade missions, as you are well aware, and also do some international trade shows. And Minnesota's track record in exporting is very good. You'll see on page 28, there's a chart that shows Minnesota against the national averages, and for the most part, Minnesota has either kept pace with or exceeded U.S. averages in our exports over the last few years. So we've done well with exporting, and that is the work of the trade office to do that. That's the end of our budget section there, Mr. Chairman. There's also the trade office page with their summary, which is, as you can tell, largely personnel costs.
This is really the only simply funded or one of the few programs we have that's funded rather simply. It's funded with $1.4 million from the general fund, a total of $2.9 million for the biennium, and it's purely a general fund cost to help Minnesota companies export. In 2005, our exports grew 17% compared to a 10% U.S. average. So exporting is good news for Minnesota's economy.
When you say help export, is it mostly advice on how to get it done? Is that what it is?
Classes, problem solving, some trade missions, some international trade shows. But we have taught hundreds of companies how to wade through the process of successfully exporting.
Do we need to...
I think so.
Chairman Metzen's not here, but do we need to streamline any of our laws to make it easier?
Most of them are things like Homeland Security rules, federal commerce licensing, how do you get paid, how do you meet federal rules. I think our rules are pretty simple. Very little of what they do, to the best of my knowledge, is sorting through state law. Is that
Paul?
Okay.
All right. If we could move on to the next section,
absolutely.
Starts on page 30.
Sure.
Thank you, Mark.
Sure.
Rick Caligiuri is going to join me.
Senator Dibble.
Sorry, I wanted to back up for 1 second.
Surely.
Question I didn't get in on the urban initiative loans. I was reading in the background narrative that these loans have leveraged an additional $45 million in private funds. Is this related to some of the federally guaranteed small business loans that we see that are administered through local jurisdictions?
These are through nonprofits like MITA and Women Ventures and a wide variety of others that get, some of them raise money privately, some of them get foundation money. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they leverage SBA money with...
They can.
Can they, Paul? John, if you can let Paul come up.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that probably rents the that represents the bulk of the private money that each individual borrower has raised from either banks or equity in terms of their expansion.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Who's next?
All right. Thank you, Mark. Rick Caligiuri is going to come up. Rick's going to explain the workforce development programs, except for state services for the blind, which Chuck Hamilton will come up for. But Rick is going to work with us for pages, to begin with, 30 through 40.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee.
For the record, my name is Rick Caligiuri. I'm the Director of Job Seeker Services within the Workforce Development Division.
Are you related to any of the Caligiuris in Chisholm?
I'm related to the Caligiuris in Hibbing. That's where I'm from.
That could be the same ones then.
Mr. Chair, members, I will go over two major program areas within the Workforce Development Division, both adult services and business services. And I'll begin on page 33 of your budget documents with the programs that serve adults. First program is the Dislocated Worker Program. This program is a very prominent program within the department, and it is the program that comes into play with many of the high-profile mass layoffs that you hear about in the news and that get a lot of play in the press. And that would be layoffs like Northwest Airlines, Ainsworth, Anderson Windows, Boston Scientific, 3M, and, of course, the Ford plant in St. Paul. Basically, this program is available for individuals who have been laid off through no fault of their own. And in the case of the mass layoffs, services are begin on-site, hopefully before the layoff occurs. And individuals who are laid off from small firms can also be served through our workforce center system statewide. There's also a federal program that is similar in nature. It's called the Trade Act. There are two components to that program. And that program serves specific manufacturing layoffs where the layoffs occur specifically because of foreign competition or the offshoring of jobs. There's a program called the Workforce Investment Act Adult Services Program. That program, again, provides an array of job-seeking services as well as training services for adults, and those services are also available through the Workforce Center system. By the way, Mr. Chair and members, most of these programs are, the services are delivered through a state and local partnership through the 16 workforce service areas throughout the state. The state administers and oversees the program, monitors the activity on the programs, makes the appropriations to the local areas in many cases, but services are quite often provided by local partners, and there is oversight at the local area through local workforce investment boards. The job seeker services, most people know as job service. Those are the services that are available to the general public. And again, there's a wide array of services available for job seekers. Anyone can come into a workforce center statewide, sit down in the resource room to a computer, and access job openings, input their resume, look for jobs, get access to career information, labor market information. They have workshops for job seekers that help with resume writing as well as job-seeking activities. And, again, that's a full array of services that's available in any workforce center statewide for the general public. The veterans programs are specific programs that work with veterans, and we also provide the general job-seeking array of services that are available for the general public. But in addition to that, there is both some case management and advocacy for veterans that our 35 veterans employment specialists statewide are engaged in. They partner very closely with both the National Guard and Reserve units, and they're heavily involved in the reintegration process that happens for the individuals coming back from active duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. They were very much gearing up for about 3,500 individuals coming back in March, and that has been delayed till this summer. And we're expecting, I believe it's nearly 6,000 people in the next 2 years.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pearson.
Mr. Caligiuri, on the Veterans Service, are they placed in county offices or in nearby county offices, or are they regionally placed?
The veterans employment representatives are normally located in workforce centers throughout the state, but they cover a large area. There are many of them that cover multiple counties. Okay. And, again, they partner very, very closely with other veterans organizations as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Senator Pearson, the veterans workforce representatives are dealing with the specific issue of assisting veterans in returning to the workforce. In addition to that, There are county veteran service officers and employees of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs that principally assist veterans in qualifying for their federal benefits, VA insurance, VA health care, other issues. The people who work for DEED are very focused on job seeking and on workforce.
Thank you. I'm going to one of the veterans meetings again this evening down in Goodhue County, which
yes,
they always have a great turnout down there. So.
Mr. Chair, members, the Senior Community Service Employment Program is a federal program that provides part-time jobs for older workers, and that program is operated both with our workforce centers and other independent service providers statewide. The Opportunities Industrialization Centers, or the OICs.
You said the Senior Community Service Employment Program was a federal program. How much do we have money in it? From the state, or do we just?
I don't believe we have any state money in that program. Mr. Stavros, do you know how much federal money we get for that program?
As I recall, it's about $1.5 million.
I believe it's a little over $1 million, yes.
Per year?
And with no federal, with no state investment in it whatsoever.
So we're just the agency that runs.
We administer the federal funds through the Workforce Center program.
Mr. Chair, members, again, back to the Opportunities Industrialization Centers. This is a pass-through appropriation to these centers. There are five of these centers statewide, three of them in the metro area, two in greater Minnesota. They serve economically disadvantaged target groups of individuals, and many of the people that they serve have barriers to employment, and they have a complete array of comprehensive services that they offer to those populations. There are actually three programs that we operate in partnership with the Department of Human Services. There's the Minnesota Family Investment Program, or MFIP program, the Food Support Employment and Training Program, and then I'll skip over briefly the Displaced Homemaker Program and come back to that. And on page 35, there's also the Diversionary Work Program. Those three programs, as I said, we operate in partnership with the Department of Human Services. They are the lead agency on those programs. And there's basically an array of support services and employment services geared toward individuals who are either on public assistance or going on public assistance or transitioning off of public assistance. The Displaced Homemaker Program is a program where, again, it is a pass-through appropriation. It's funded entirely from a fee on marriage licenses and divorce filings. And there are six independent service providers statewide that provide services specifically to the profile of a displaced homemaker would be an individual, usually a woman, who has been a homemaker most of her life and either through death, disability, or divorce, all of a sudden finds himself having to get on into the job market and become and earn a living and without skills or education, et cetera. And again, there are a full array of services, support services, and employment services that are available at those centers to help those individuals.
This was at one point had some. Did this have some general fund money back in 2001 or two or somewhere in that area?
Mr. Chair, yes, it did.
But now there's no general fund money. It's totally on the fees that you mentioned.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It's totally funded from the fees, and I believe that's to the tune of about $1 million a year.
Okay.
There is some program information on pages 35 and 36, and I would be happy to answer any questions you would have on any of these programs that serve adult.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Do you have any numbers that would let us know how many veterans returning from overseas, or I guess this primarily relates to those in the Guard? I know they have some legal protection to be able to return to their jobs, but for a variety of reasons, that protection doesn't always equate to a job being there when they get back. Do you know what percentage of people returning from overseas find themselves unemployed and in need of assistance from the state?
Mr. Chair, members, I have heard the number 12%, and those are national numbers. that are not job attached when they return from deployment.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I asked a similar question to our veterans people last week, and they said they thought our number was close to the national number in the range of 11% to 12%. The reason it happens is their employer may have gone out of business in the period while they were gone. Their job may have been moved to another state and they don't want to move. Something happened, as you said, to disassociate them from their job. But we think somewhere in the range of 10 to 12% of the people coming back will need our help. Others may have become overqualified for the job they were in when they left by virtue of training they received while in the service and may ask for help to find jobs that pay better than the one they left or for which their new qualifications now suit them.
Mr.
Do those who are self-employed fall into any of these categories? In other words, those who might have lost the ability to maintain a business because they've had to be away from it for so long?
I do not know the answer to that. Do any of our team back here? We're going to have to find that answer for you. Lynn, would you make a note of that and check with Jim? I didn't look at Paul. Do you know the answer to that? We'll find out. That's a very good question, and I don't know the answer. We'll find it.
Thank you.
Also, Mr. Chair and Senator, there are federal laws that do protect, give some job protection to those individuals, particularly the Guard and Reserve individuals who have jobs. And I believe those federal laws are called USERRA, and I've forgotten what that acronym stands for. But the USERRA laws do give them some job protection.
And our veteran service people, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, said most of the time they work, sometimes they don't, and that's that number of around 11 or 12%. And we'll find out if that includes self-employed.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Mr. Caligiuri, do you have more?
I'm going to go to the money on 37.
Mr. Chair, members, the fiscal information is on 37. Basically, we do not have any new items or change items here. So the what you see here reflects what was targeted as being base appropriations going forward, and minus the one-time appropriations that have happened in the current biennium.
We spend about $196 million in this area. Of that, $129 million comes from federal funds, $62 million from the Workforce Development Fund, $1.9 million from miscellaneous special revenue, and then there are direct appropriations in this area of $610,000 from the general fund and $2.25 million from the Workforce Development Fund. Those are general directed appropriations that were contained in the budget bill passed in 2005. All right. Go on to page 38, please.
38.
Mr. Chair, members, the programs that begin on page 38 are those workforce programs that are specifically targeted toward businesses. And we'll start out with business service field operations. And I know your budget book says 35 business service specialists, but I believe we're up to about 40 right now. Individuals that whose basic focus is to, in the local area, contact local businesses and try to find out what their workforce needs and help them with issues such as workforce retention, recruitment of workers, and other strategies, workforce strategies. And they work hand in hand with the individuals in our business and community development division. And when they do address and find issues related to both expansion or contraction or relocation issues, we engage the partnership of our members of the Business Community Development Division as well. I just saw a report just prior to coming here on the amount of business contacts they've made. And again, this is all in broken down by fiscal year, but giving you more current information. I just saw calendar year 2006 information on these business service specialists. And they had contacted more than 5,000 businesses and made, I believe it was 6,200 business consultation. And again, that's in calendar year 2006.
On page 39, there's some numbers shown for fiscal year 2006, and the number's a little smaller than that. But this program has been increasing training and contacts. And so the 5,000 number is the same number I had for calendar 2006. This is getting to be, it's very useful also in keeping businesses in Minnesota because we can answer their workforce questions. It resulted in 26,000 employers opening accounts on Minnesota's Job Bank and 164,000 Minnesota Job Bank job seekers accessing the system. So we wouldn't have an active job bank if we didn't have the business service specialists out connecting us to Minnesota employers.
Mr. Chair, members, also we mentioned here industry specialists, and to be very strategic with the growth of our business community and jobs in our state, we try to be very strategic and entertain both in industry and sectoral approaches. We have industry specialists in manufacturing, healthcare, transportation, and financial services industries that work closely with businesses in those industries as well as industry associations. Minnesota's Job Bank is our electronic labor exchange system. This is a system where anybody looking for a job can input a resume, and any employer can put a job order in. You can do this remotely via the internet. It's a free service to both businesses and individuals. It's the largest job bank or electronic job bank in the state, and we are currently upgrading the search engine and software to that system, and that will be available in April and have many, many new features and be a very robust and state-of-the-art system. The Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Program is actually a group of grant programs that is targeted toward helping businesses meet their training needs for incumbent workers. And these are basically grant programs that, again, are targeted to a business or a group of businesses partnered with an educational institution. And the grant then pays for the educational institution to design and develop and deliver customized training that meets the specific needs of that business.
How many, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pearson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Caligiuri, how many of the how many of the educational institution partners in that particular segment are above the technical college level, or are they mostly tech colleges? I know that a couple of them around us, they do a lot of customary training. They've been doing it for many years.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the statute basically just says it needs to be an accredited institution. I would say the vast majority of the grants end up going to Minsky institutions. But the University of Minnesota is also involved, as well as several private colleges.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just curious about that. So who initiates the idea, if you will? Who applies for the grant? Is it the group of businesses, or is it Minsky, or is it?
Mr. Chair, businesses and educational institutions, customized training within Minsky, they have customized training reps throughout the state that go and knock on the doors of businesses and ask what their training needs are, as well as our DEEDS business service representative statewide. And so businesses will find out about the grant program, and then it's a matter of finding the right educational partner for them to meet their needs. And then it's actually the educational institution that puts forward the grant.
But in order to put forward a grant, Mr. Chairman, Senator, they can't put it together speculatively. They have to identify in their application who their business partner is, and there's a match required. Sometimes there's some hard dollars. Sometimes it's the employee's time, supervisor costs, facilities costs. But the educational institution puts in the application on behalf of the partnership.
And Mr. Chair, I assume this is also related to the work that the industry specialists carry out. I was going to ask that earlier.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, the industry specialists are very much knowledgeable on this program and involved as well.
Great. Thank you.
The Foreign Labor Certification Program is actually it's kind of misleading. It's basically a process, a federally mandated process, where primarily agricultural employers have to go through this process. In order to hire foreign workers, they first must prove that they cannot hire American workers. And this is the department is involved in just this aspect of the process. It usually deals with agricultural employers and landscaping companies, but again, they are required by law to go through a formal process to determine that there are no American workers that will take the jobs.
Senator Paris, well, there was some heavy breathing going over there.
I'm going to resist talking about this.
Okay. Go to page 40 and just give me a...
There's one more program on page 39. That's the Work Opportunity Tax Credit and Welfare to Work Tax Credit Program. Those are, again, federal programs that provide tax credits to employers when they hire individuals from specific target groups, and they're usually pretty much economically disadvantaged individuals.
And I can handle page 40, or Rick can. This is a very simple, also financing page. There are no initiatives in this area. We spend $13,599,000. It comes from a general fund appropriation plus money that we get from, the general fund direct appropriation is $13,599. The spending is $21,799, made up of that general fund appropriation, some miscellaneous special revenue, and $8 million from the federal government. The expenditure by category you see, compensation, other operating assistance. The local assistance is grants to the Job Skills Partnership applications. And the total spending for the biennium is $21.8 million. Rick, thank you. You're going to be back up to do some other programs in a minute.
Commissioner, one quick question. I noticed that the workforce development number is zeroed out in 08 and 09. What does that mean exactly? In the expenditures by fund under statutory appropriations?
Mr. Stavros, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there was some taxpayer money appropriated in 06, 07 from the Workforce Development Fund, from Job Skills Partnership. Job Skills Partnership Board has some authority to transfer, but the governor's budget doesn't include a transfer from the Job Skills Partnership from the fund. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, 2 years ago, the legislature passed a bill saying that basically the Job Skills Partnership Board at the end of the year can review if there are balances, depending on the dislocated worker activity, and if there are balances left over from dislocated workers, they can make incumbent worker grants, appropriate grant money to serve incumbent workers, and that's what you see here. There, last year, they appropriated some money for incumbent worker training grants.
So it could happen again.
Mr. Chair, they do have that statutory authority ongoing. Basically, I think the law says after March 1st of each year, reviewing a bunch of economic information to see, you know, what the needs of dislocated workers are, that they can move that money toward incumbent workers.
Okay.
All right. The next program I'm going to explain, and then Kim Peck will come up and explain rehabilitation services. So thank you, Rick. He'll be back. The program on page 41 is our disability determination program. The narrative is on 41, and the dollars are on 42. This is a service that state employees provide to the U.S. Federal Social Security Administration. It's done this way across the country, to do the interviewing and application review to determine eligibility for Social Security Disability Program. We have approximately 167 people in downtown St. Paul at the Metro Square building. It's 100% paid for with federal funds. The cost is $46 million a year. This group has won awards from the Social Security Administration for their on-time performance, for the accuracy of their work, but it is a contract function, essentially, that state employees do on behalf of the federal government. Ms. Peck.
Commissioner, just out of curiosity, we see federal in other parts of the budget, but we don't see federal deed in other parts of the budget. Is it just because it's federal money coming to deed, or is it?
Correct. I think that's.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's a little more confusing than that. The old Department of Economic Security had a identified federal appropriation in the state's accounting system, which is now known as federal deed. The old Department of Trade and Economic Development had a federal fund that was just federal, and just because of the inconvenience of merging them, they're listed as separate in these separate places, but there is no distinction there. And one day, we'll get with the Department of Finance and tackle merging them together. But there's no substantial difference in the funds.
Well, one indicates coming from one place and one indicates coming from another.
They came before the merger and they just haven't been put together, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Kim Pack is our Director of Rehabilitation Services. So she's going to explain the program from page 43 through 49. If you'd state your name for the record.
Yes. Good afternoon.
Let me ask a question here. Is there a way that you could skip to page 45 and explain the money and the program at the same time?
That's my intent.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I appreciate being succinct, so I will do my best to do that. Good afternoon. As Commissioner McElroy said, my name is Kimberly Pack. I'm the Director of Rehabilitation Services. I need to briefly explain how Rehabilitation Services fits into the mission of DEED, because the work that we do is a bit different than what you've heard thus far this afternoon. Rehabilitation Services' mission is to empower Minnesotans with disabilities to achieve their goals for employment, independent living, and community integration. I believe that our work is critical to DEED's overall objective to support the economic success of individuals, businesses, and communities. It's common knowledge that significant workforce shortages are looming as baby boomers are beginning to retire. And the fact is that in Minnesota, nearly 12% of working-age population are persons with disabilities. Persons with disabilities present a significant untapped labor pool. The employment rate currently in Minnesota for working-age Minnesotans with disabilities is only 44.9%. That's in contrast to an 83.5% employment rate for working-age Minnesotans without disabilities. This is a large complement of individuals with very marketable skills, a strong desire to work. They just happen to have disabilities. Briefly, I will review the three primary services or components of rehabilitation services. All three of these programs have a distinct connection to assisting individuals with disabilities with employment-related issues. The vocational rehabilitation program, which I will be talking about in a few minutes, actually started in 1920 to assist World War I vets returning from their service to the country. They acquired a disability in their service, and so the federal government made efforts to assist them in their return to work. As you might imagine, the program has changed significantly in the last 80 years. Our primary services in the vocational rehabilitation program are assessment, education, training, and job placement. And it's important to note that the services of vocational rehabilitation are time-limited. The second component of rehabilitation services is the Extended Employment Program. And this program is a state appropriation that enables the provision of services to persons who, given the specific nature of their disability, require ongoing supports in order to maintain their job. As I said just a minute ago, vocational rehabilitation services are time limited. In contrast, the services provided under the Extended Employment Program are ongoing. The third component of rehabilitation services is the independent living program, which provides persons with disabilities the support they need to remain independent or to increase their independence in their homes and communities. What I would like to do in terms of presenting these change initiatives to you is, in consistent with the order as they present in your book, ask you to turn your attention to the extended employment narrative on page 43. As I said just a minute ago, the extended employment program, and you may find me refer to that as EE, that's the acronym that we use, but the extended employment program makes it possible for persons with significant disabilities to maintain their jobs and advance in their career. Because of the nature of their disability, were it not for those ongoing supports, they would likely be unable to continue to be competitively employed. The extended employment program in Minnesota actually is quite unique across the country. Minnesota, I'm proud to say, has one of the highest rates of employment for persons with disabilities. And frankly, I believe that is largely, or in large part, due to the state's investment in providing these ongoing supports in the extended employment program. Other states in the country do not have the similar level of investment in ongoing supports to persons with disabilities. So something, frankly, that I think Minnesota can be very, very proud of. In the extended employment program, as you'll see described on page 43, there are two programs. One is the extended employment basic program, and there's another, the extended employment program, specifically for persons with serious mental illness. I'd ask you to turn your attention to page 46, the change item specific to the extended employment basic program. The extended employment program basically works by providing funding for community and center-based employment through a network of community providers such as Goodwill Easter Seals in St. Paul, Occupational Development Center up in northern Minnesota that has about 8 or 9 locations. The EE Basic program serves approximately 6,000 people per year. And the funding that goes to the community provider organizations is outcome-based. In other words, these providers are reimbursed based on the number of hours worked by participants in the extended employment program. In state fiscal year 06, almost 5 million hours were worked by participants in the extended employment basic program. The total wages they earned were $27.6 million, with an average earning an average wage per hour of $5.52. And the amount of money provided through the extended employment program to providers, community providers, for state fiscal year 06 was $11.8 million. Now, in 2005, the legislature appropriated $500,000 of one-time funding in the biennium, for each biennium, from the Workforce Development Fund. The budget initiative that you see described in page 46 is to make that appropriation permanent, to replace that one-time funding with permanent funding from the general fund. And it is our view that in doing this, we will be able to continue jobs for as many 350 persons with significant disabilities. Moving to page 47, a change item, it's similar to the one for the EE Basic Program. This is specific to the change item for the EE Program for persons with serious mental illness. How this works, again, is it provides funding for ongoing support services for persons with a serious mental illness. There are 26 projects throughout Minnesota that provide services through this program. And the services that are provided are the ongoing supports and placement services as needed to individuals with serious mental illness. There's a distinct difference between the EESMI, is the acronym for that, and the EE Basic Program in that the providers are reimbursed on a unit of service basis. And the EESMI program is unique in that it really is designed to respond to or address the unique needs that come with serious mental illness, the remitting nature of that illness, and also is designed in a way that's consistent with the evidence-based practice for services targeted for persons with serious mental illness. Just briefly, some of the statistics from the state fiscal year 06. The EESMI program served almost 1,000 persons. The average wage earned by those individuals was $8.82, earning a total wages in state fiscal year 06 of $1.8 million. This budget initiative, again, that you see on page 47, would make the 2005 one-time appropriation of $400,000 permanent, retaining the current capacity of service delivery in the EESMI program and saving the jobs for nearly as many 225 persons. So that concludes my testimony regarding the extended employment program and the change items. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Are there any questions? Senator Dibble. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I often get confused when we're talking about preserving the base and adding new. When we talk about both in the basic and the serious mental illness EE programs, when you say continue jobs for 200 to 350 individuals in one case and 175 to 225 individuals, those are folks that were able to serve as a result of the one-time additional funds provided in the previous biennium in addition to the 6,000 individuals and the 800 individuals. So we're not just going to be serving, you know, 350 individuals in one case and just serving 225 individuals in another.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct.
Okay.
My understanding of the purpose for the one-time appropriation from the Workforce Development Fund in 2005 was to support a rate increase that went to the community providers. As we look at the numbers in terms of those funds that pass through deed to the community providers, we really are at capacity in this program. And so to not transfer those one-time funds to base would in essence be a cut in the program, and we'd be able to provide support to significantly less individuals.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, we'll go on to the independent living program on page 48.
You have my permission.
The independent living program, actually, I was just sure that I have it. As I mentioned briefly, the independent living program is part of the rehabilitation services, and this program is designed to provide services to individuals to increase their degree of independence in their home or to make it possible for them to stay at home as compared to being in a different facility or away from their home. Presently, in the independent living program, there are funds devoted to the operation of 6 centers for independent living throughout Minnesota, as well as funds that are allocated to staff in the vocational rehabilitation program to provide independent living services for individuals in the community. We're not at this point in time looking to make any requests in the current appropriation for the independent living program.
Senator Pariseau.
Mr. Chairman, ma'am, my question is, you have the independent living facility, those are residential facilities then, is that correct?
Mr. Chair.
Or are you talking about the Center for Independent Living who also go out and help build ramps at people's homes so they can stay in their own homes?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct. The independent living centers are programs who have 4 core priorities, and that's to do some skill training around independent living skills, to provide peer counseling, also to promote information and advocacy. There are 8 independent living centers who receive funds both from the federal government as well as the state. There's a small amount, essentially $115,000, that is passed through to the VR or the vocational rehabilitation counselors to also provide similar services to individuals they are working with who require that. A good example of the services provided from the independent living centers or through this program would be, as you suggest, building a ramp so someone can actually enter or exit their home. Another very good example is skill training around the use of metro mobility so an individual is able to get to and from work.
Commissioner.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm thinking about my mother when we had the center put a ramp up. She was mad about that. It identified her in the community, but at any rate, they were very, very helpful. It was very good, and they sent some people out to help her with the motor skills as well. Which,
Mr. Chairman, we'd like to go on then to state services.
She didn't love either. So,
Kim, Ms. Beck will be back in a few minutes with the voc rehab services. Chuck Hamilton is going to come to the table and will briefly, and I say that because Chuck is so passionate about state services for the blind, he has been known to go on a little. But Chuck is going to briefly explain the programs on pages 50 through 53.
I think I've received a message from the boss.
Yes?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman,
unless
members of the committee.
Unless I tell you differently.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
My name is Chuck Hamilton, and I am the Director of State Services for the Blind. State Services, our acronym, by the way, is SSB. SSB serves blind, visually impaired, and deafblind persons across Minnesota. In our communication center, where our change request is, and you'll learn about in a few minutes, we also serve physically handicapped and other print handicapped persons, such as persons with dyslexia. We have served Minnesota since 1923, for many years as part of the welfare and human services system, and since 1985 as part of the economic security and workforce center services system. We are located across the state in 13 workforce centers and our office in the Midway District of St. Paul. SSB has 4 major areas of service, and I will inform you a little of each. Here's where I will try to speed it up a little bit. We do work with customers who are going to work. We also work with people who are primarily interested in independent living in their community and in their home, but not going to work. We also focus on individualized assistive technology, technology that both workers and non-workers need to access the printed word. And finally, through our communication center, where I'll spend more time, SSB provides public library types of service, making ink print accessible to Minnesota residents. The communication center is probably the best known of our services. It makes ink print accessible in a variety of ways. First, we actually operate a radio station called the Radio Talking Book Network. The Radio Talking Book Network reads newspapers and current bestsellers. Our partners at Minnesota Public Radio help us deliver the service across Minnesota. We also have a partnership with the Minnesota Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped in Faribault to make available books that have been recorded nationally by the Library of Congress. We also tape, and in the future will digitize, college textbooks for eligible students. We transcribe K-12 textbooks into Braille, and as a result of an agreement with the Department of Education, we also Braille for anyone else. That is why you have a copy of the Braille in your book. That was done a while back. A geography teacher, was working with the primary level students, and the students were studying the Upper Midwest, the major rivers, the capitals, the states, and that kind of thing. We have volunteers, which I'll talk about, who actually will take the maps, the equations in math, and other kinds of graphically based things and make a tactile picture, and that's what the example you have of is. We operate and sponsor two telephone-based newspaper reading services, Dial-In News for local papers and NFP Newsline for national newspapers and newspapers from other states. The Communication Center was started in 1953 with a grant from the Ham family, a well-known name here in Minnesota. The project continues as a model public-private partnership with a very active fundraising element. The Communication Center utilizes over 670 qualified volunteers who primarily develop the content for Communication Center services. Their outstanding service translates into a gift of $1.7 million of time per year. The Communication Center serves nearly 14,000 customers. Our pages are 50 through 53. I believe the change request is on page 53. The governor has requested the legislature to increase our general fund base budget by $1 million each year. $900,000 would be put directly into the Communication Center, replacing $900,000 federal dollars that would be removed and transferred to SSB's Workforce Development Unit. As I have already mentioned, it was in the longer version, the services our customers need to go to work are expensive, and they continue to rise, in that we have projected insufficient funds this next fiscal year to meet all our needs for customers going to work. This transfer would keep us from cutting services to job seekers or make cuts in the Communication Center. These federal dollars have always been primarily intended to be used directly in working with customers going to work, a fact our federal partner has made quite clear to us. The additional $100,000 is necessary to continue to match all the federal dollars we receive. Mr. Chairman, I'll end my presentation right there.
Any questions?
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you.
Sorry to rush you. Kim Peck will come back up.
Your kids didn't put the locations of the service centers on the map, though, right?
Excuse me?
They didn't put the locations of the service centers on the Braille.
The workforce centers?
Yeah.
No.
No, yeah.
No, those were capitals primarily.
You said there were 13 of them only.
Well, 13, state services for the blind is located at 13. We're a very small entity, and we can't cover the state. We have responsibility for all 87 counties, and we do serve all 87 counties. So some of our staff do have to travel quite a bit. But the Braille piece was just for the students.
Thank you.
Is an example of an elementary textbook. And I asked that it be put in because I thought it was amazing that we could do not only the printed page, but things like maps and rivers and capitals and state boundaries. Ms. Peck. Ms. Peck, we'll take you through the budget pages 54 through 56.
Hello again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As I commented a few minutes ago, the Vocational Rehabilitation Program is one of the three programs under the umbrella organization Rehabilitation Services, and the acronym commonly used for vocational rehabilitation is VR. Essentially, VR is an employment and training program for persons with severe disabilities, and it provides time-limited services directly via professional staff and by purchase of services from local communities. These services include assessment, vocational evaluation, rehabilitation counseling, training and education, assistive technology, and job placement. In federal fiscal year 06, VR served over 20,000 persons with disabilities statewide at various stages in service delivery, from application to services to closure for successful rehabilitation. Specifically, in federal fiscal year 06, we took in about 6,500 new applications, signed over 4,000 employment plans, which is that document that makes the contract, if you will, between the vocational rehabilitation program and the job seeker to spell out those steps and services that will be taken to assist them in accomplishing their vocational goal. There were 2,500, a bit more than 2,500 individuals who achieved their employment goal and went to work, and the average wage for those individuals working without supports was $10.79, working an average number of hours per week of 31 and a half hours per week. The average length of involvement that an individual may have with a vocational rehabilitation program is anywhere between 30 and 34 months. The change item that you see on page 56 is specific to the state match that's required for the vocational rehabilitation program. The VR program is a partnership between the federal government, specifically the Department of Education, and the state. Federal appropriation is determined by a formula based on the state population and per capita income. The federal fiscal year 07 appropriation, we're operating under continuing resolution now, is approximately $34.5 million. And the good news, frankly, for vocational rehabilitation is that the federal government does continue to make additional funds available. However, in order for states to pull those monies down, they're required to make the match. And that match is a 21.3% match. I believe Commissioner McElroy commented on this in his earlier comments, that every state dollar that's appropriated to the vocational rehabilitation program will pull down $3.70 from the federal government.
I'm back on the independent living page where it says the services provided through a grant program can go to the Centers for Independent Living and the state vocational rehab program. Can these dollars in any way be applied to Centers for Independent Living also? Or are these VR dollars? And maybe more specifically, why is there a recommended increase here and nothing at the Centers for Independent Living?
Mr. Chair, let me answer your first question first. The question being, can any of the VR dollars be appropriated to the independent living centers or the delivery of independent living services? The VR dollars, and known as 110 monies, are very explicit in terms of how they can be used. They must be used to specific individuals for a specific service that is identified in the employment plan. There are some funds, what we refer to as our program income, for individuals who are receiving Social Security benefits. They come to VR. We help them get a job off benefits. At a later point in time, we can be reimbursed for the cost of services that we provided to that individual that made it possible for them to get off of Social Security. Those program income funds, we have a bit more latitude with, and we have historically worked closely with the independent living centers to assist them in their capacity issues with granting some of the program income monies to them.
The vast majority of the money we get from the federal government comes under Section 110 of the Federal Vocational Rehabilitation Act, and we cannot use that for independent living. And the reason that the governor's recommending an increase here is to serve the number of people who need to be served and to take advantage of the federal dollars that are available if we have the match. That's not the case in the SILS money.
SILS money has a big return, though, by keeping the people living out there independently and not having to get other services.
It wouldn't be in our budget at the level it is, Senator, if we weren't supportive, but we don't have the opportunity to bring down additional match.
I noticed that they were both mentioned in the program page on the Centers for Independent Living, so I was just wondering if there was a connection between the two. That was the reason for my question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go on.
Again, this budget initiative would allow us, with $1.5 million per year of the biennium, it would, a $3 million increase would allow us to draw down over $10 million from the federal government. It's interesting to note that, frankly, from my perspective, there's little time to spare in that in the federal fiscal year 06, we fell short $382,000 of federal match in order to pull down the monies that the federal government had on the table. And were it not for the fact that the state fiscal year and the federal fiscal year overlap, we would have had to return $1.4 million to the feds at the end of federal fiscal year 06. So that's the practical reality in that we have maximized our ability to pull down additional federal dollars. The more kind of customer-oriented focus would be the fact that not being able to pull down those additional dollars would dramatically reduce our capacity to get Minnesotans with disabilities into jobs. You know, we have over a number of years experienced the flat funding with significantly increased costs. You may be interested in knowing that post-secondary education, tuition costs for post-secondary education is one of our biggest ticket items. And we look at the tuition increases over the past 10 years for MNSCU, for the community and technical ed programs, they've increased 53%. For the four-year programs in MNSCU over the past 10 years, tuition expenses have increased 65%. Certainly, our increases in the federal government, from the federal government, nowhere even begin to match those tuition increases. So we really have come to a place, given those rising costs, given essentially the flat funding, that we are at maximum capacity to provide the services with the existing resources that we've got. Also, as Commissioner McElroy commented early in his introductory remarks, inability to draw down additional federal funds would leave us no alternative but to reinstitute the waiting list for people interested in accessing VR services. The federal regulations require that if there aren't enough resources to go around, that services must be provided to individuals with the most significant disabilities first. And so that's the order of selection that Commissioner McElroy referred to earlier. We've worked hard over the past couple of years to manage that waiting list, to get in front of it, but without additional state appropriation, we'll be hard-pressed to continue that forward progress. So I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about the change items specific to the vocational rehabilitation program.
Any questions?
Thank you. And Kim, thank you very much.
Yep.
Rick Calgeri will come back up and explain his other program on pages 57 through 60.
Commissioner, we got about 20 minutes.
And we'll
have a little less than 15 pages to go.
We're going to make it, Senator.
But I think we got time. And if we have to go over just a little bit, that's okay, because
some of the last pages having to do with unemployment and administration will go fairly quickly, Senator.
All right. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to briefly describe the youth programs under workforce development, we have the WIA Title I Youth Formula Grant. These are federal funds that we receive from the Department of Labor to serve economically disadvantaged youth. We allocate this money out by formula to the local areas, and again, oversight by the local workforce investment boards and various programs that are available for kids from ages 14 through 21, mostly in summer programs, but in some cases year-round situations as well. Along with that, there's also the Minnesota Youth Program, which is funded with state funds. And that parallels the WIA Youth Formula Grant. And, again, that's formula allocated to the local areas. And the local areas utilize that money pretty much seamlessly with the WIA funds. But the one proviso is that the Minnesota Youth Program funding is a little bit more flexible than the federal funds. The Minneapolis Summer Youth Employment Program is a new initiative that began just this last July. And there's an appropriation from the Workforce Development Fund for the city of Minneapolis to employ both summer and year-round youth with this program. The Youth Build program targets older kids, and in particular, they're usually more at-risk kids. They're involved in construction projects primarily, but also some community service projects, mostly construction. And there's also a juvenile justice kind of connection with this program, and many of these kids are on probation, dropouts, et cetera. And there's some program information on page 58 on these programs, as well as the funding information on page 59.
Can you explain the career guides initiative on page 60?
Mr. Chair, there is a change item here, and this is basically a concept that we piloted 2 years ago in St. Cloud, and then last year in 14 local areas with a very small amount of carry-in funds that we had. And the concept is basically to train college kids, and they serve basically as interns and can get academic credit as well as being paid. And they go and work in the high schools with guidance counselors. As you well know, the student-to-counselor ratio in our high schools is very, very high. And most counselors spend most of their time doing crisis intervention and dealing with other personal issues and don't do a lot of career counseling. So these college kids basically work with the counselors, and they will do work directly with youth, and they'll take them to various sites. They'll take them to workforce centers, college campuses, and work with them on setting career goals and showing them what kinds of information is available to make career and educational decisions. The governor is requesting $500,000 from the general fund for this initiative to be an ongoing initiative. It's been very, very successful in the pilots in all areas where it's been tried. I guess I can speak to this firsthand with a 16-year-old son. Even though I'm an employment and training expert, he doesn't want to hear it from me. But he listens to his two older cousins that are in college, so that's a good thing.
I found that out coaching my kid when I told him to tie his skates. He wouldn't listen to me, but I had to send the other coach over, and then he tied his skates. I understand that completely. Also.
Yes, parents don't know anything. Friends do.
Yes, okay.
And the pilot results from this program were very encouraging. We think it's an exciting initiative. It does two things. It helps college students advance their career interest in counseling, and it adds counseling capacity to our high schools. And so we think it's a really good investment in its workforce. It's going to help people make great choices for college. So we're excited about it. Any other questions for Rick?
Counselors must love it too, do they?
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Senator Dibble.
So I just didn't quite hear it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Funding is recommended to continue for the Minnesota Youth Program and the Minneapolis Summer Youth Employment Program.
Mr. Chair, are you asking about the Minnesota Youth Program?
I'm asking about both.
Okay. The Minnesota Youth Program had a one-time appropriation in the current biennium.
I believe the Minneapolis Summer Youth is in the base, however. Mr. Stavros, is that correct? And there is, we continue to have significant federal money for Minnesota Youth. We did not have, we ran out of, we have to set priorities too, and we ran out of funds before recommending a state appropriation for Minnesota Youth this year.
But the monies for those programs, do they come from the Workforce Development Fund then?
The federal funds come from the federal government, from the Department of Labor. The Minneapolis appropriation is from which fund, Mr. Stavros?
From the Workforce Development Fund.
Yes.
And youth bill the same, right?
Correct.
And Mr. Chair, the youth bill is the base on youth bill is coming from the general fund. The base on the summer youth program is coming from the Workforce Development Fund.
Sorry,
Senator Dibble.
And how many dollars? I'm grateful for the Minneapolis summer youth program, but I'm a state senator. So the Minneapolis Youth Program, Minnesota Youth Program, federal dollars, how much is that?
The Minnesota Youth Program, again, is funded entirely from the Workforce Development Fund, $3 million per year in the last biennium.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe you're asking about the federal youth money under the Workforce Investment Act. Was that your question? That's approximately $10 million a year.
No, I'm sorry. The Minnesota Youth, the MYP.
Okay, MYP.
Yeah. How much do we fund that at? By whatever source?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's being funded at $2.5 million for the biennium. And the program is limited at this time to the city of Minneapolis.
So the general MYP program is not recommended to be funded for 0809, Senator. That's
from any source.
From state funding. The WIA Youth, which does approximately the same thing, is $10 million a year.
I see. Okay. Thank you. That's clear.
And the Minneapolis program is $1.25 million a year from the Workforce Development Fund.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
All right. With that, I'd like to go on to the unemployment insurance program on page 61, if I may. This is a program that provides a temporary partial wage replacement to workers who become unemployed. We served 283,000 in 2005. This is about $1.5 billion in benefits for the biennium. It is funded by employer-paid unemployment insurance taxes. We also spend about $100 million per biennium on the administration of the program and on technology improvements. If you look at the program funding economic summary, page shows only our administrative and technology programs. The benefits don't show up here, as the benefits come from the federal trust fund. And so that $105,283,000 is the total of admin for the program and technology improvement for the program. We do have an initiative in this area, and it's on page 64. It is to refund to the unemployment fund, so they don't have a hole, $192,000 one time from the general fund to the unemployment insurance trust fund for certain entities which are unable to pay delinquent accounts for which we feel some government obligation. And those are the Ombudsman for Crime Victim Services, which was discontinued by the legislature a few years ago, and some charter schools that have gone out of business. And rather than leave the fund short, we'd like you to reimburse the unemployment fund from the general fund by $192,000. I apologize. I've forgotten this. We're funding a requirement here that's already in statute. The law says that we will reimburse. We need you to authorize the money by which to do so. And it's required in Minnesota Statutes 262.052, subdivision 3, subparagraph 5, but the statute doesn't automatically appropriate the money. But we're obligated to ask you to appropriate the money, and I think we also think it's a fair thing to do.
So would you be breaking the law if we didn't give you the money?
Senator, I believe you would. Or at least you'd be acting inconsistent with the statute, Senator.
Has that ever happened around here?
I'm sure this will be the first time, Senator, so I trust that you will appropriate this reimbursement.
Commissioner, I've been getting some reports on the technologies that we're trying to go to a computer-based system as opposed to the telephone operating system or a combination of both. Is that correct? I've been getting some bad reports on the technology. How is the technology going?
Well, we're in evolution. You know, we have finished phase one that has taxes being paid by employers on the new system. But the benefits are still principally on the old system. The new system for benefits will be up and running by September 30th of this year. The goal is to make it easier for employees to get information online. About 40% of our employees choose to get information online, 60% to choose to call us on the phone. Most of those use a automated voice response, touch-tone kind of system. We still have a good-sized call center in St. Paul and have a lot of people who talk to us every day. But we are in the midst of the technology improvement, Senator. It is not completed as yet.
Is it being used at all? because I'm told it's being used.
It's being used by employers to pay their to report their wages and to pay their taxes. And there are several new features that have been added to what I refer to as our legacy system, our older system. But all the features will not be in place until the 30th of September. I think what you may be referring to is during our heaviest periods of calls over the last 3 weeks, it has been somewhat difficult to get through to the phone center, particularly on Monday mornings or even on Tuesday mornings. Later in the week, it's been easier. But we have had, people have had to call back. We've had some waiting times.
I haven't got any complaints on the telephone. It was the new computer system that I've heard some horror stories about, I guess. But it sounds like it's not going to be completely ready until September.
That's correct, Senator.
Okay. So as long as it's a work in progress, that's good.
And we are continuing to make it better, we hope, every day.
Okay.
All right. The next section of the budget is our administrative section. It's the money that's used to pay for the cost of operating the agency. It's fiscal. It is things like our Human Resources Department, the fiscal staff that Mr. Stavros runs, the Office of the Commissioner. The funds for that are shown on page 67. It's $10,262,000 a year. It is a mixture of funds that come from the general fund of $6.5 million, and then $3.7 million that comes from the federal government that is essentially the federal share of our general administrative costs. It means that we administer the agency with a cost of less than 1% of our total expenditures, not counting unemployment insurance benefits. We have costs or expenditures other than unemployment of $1.2 billion for the biennium, and we administer the agency for about $10.2 million. And we think it's a very efficient operation. We do have three change items, in the administrative area. One is additional resources for labor, local labor market information. These are the people, and it's $150,000 to the base. This is a team of people that do research on employment numbers, local what is the workforce in a particular workforce service area or county. Their information is extremely critical to the Bureau of Labor Information, or Bureau of Labor Statistics, rather, and principally to our local workforce centers. In order to continue to provide their high level of service, they need additional resources, and we're recommending that. We're also recommending a one-time appropriation of $200,000 to assist us in marketing Minnesota, principally outside the state. This would be matched by public and private partners to support external marketing for new business development. Matching funds from non-state partners include a number of local economic development agencies and other partners. And one of our jobs is to attract investment in Minnesota and jobs from outside of Minnesota. We need to do some advertising and send some trade events to be able to do that. This will pay for us to attend the Bio 2007 conference, where we'll advertise Minnesota and a number of other outside Minnesota events. The compensation adjustment, which I mentioned earlier, is described on page 70. It totals $382,000. $189,000 in fiscal 08 and $382,000 in fiscal 09. It's about a 2% increase for state employees. We also, on pages 71, 72, and 73, have described some initiatives that are actually the purview of the Tax Committee, but we wanted you to be aware of them because they do affect economic development and the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The first is a tax credit for emerging business. It's often referred to as a venture capital tax credit. One of the complaints of why aren't we growing more high-tech companies in Minnesota has been a shortage of early-stage venture capital money. This would provide a 50% tax credit up to $6 million for the biennium or until spent to sometimes called angel investors or early-stage investors that make investments of up to $150,000 per individual or $600,000 per fund or group. We expect that you'll hear a testimony when our budget bill comes before you from individuals who are very excited about this. There also probably are some other bills floating through the system proposing angel tax credits that may work differently. We would have to sell this in the tax committee, but we wanted you to be aware of it. The second proposal on page 72 is a proposal to make JobZ a 10-year program, and it would clarify the expiration date of the law so that JobZ agreements entered into prior to December 31st, 2015 would have a 10-year life. Currently, the law indicates that the program sunsets December 31st, 2015, and that's led to a declining number of JobZ deals being done and to the value of the program in attracting companies and keeping companies in Minnesota declining over the next 8 years. We're recommending that we keep the sunset but have the agreements entered into between now and 2015 each be for 10 years. And again, that's a decision that will have to be made in the tax committee, but we wanted you to be aware of it. And the last one, I'm sorry, on page 73, is the sales tax exemption for the Thompson West expansion in Eagan. It will mean an investment of something over $100 million in capital, a minimum of 2,000 new jobs, and perhaps as many as 5,000 new jobs. It's consistent with tax exemptions we've offered other employers, and it's a decision that goes to the tax committee. We decided to put these in your book sort of as an FYI basis. They impact your interest, but they're not before this committee. And that, I believe, let me just check and see if I forgot anything major.
Did I forget anything major?
Mr. Chairman, I believe we've concluded our presentation with almost 3.5 minutes to spare.
Good job. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Getting back to my earlier question, because now it's coming up again on this is on page 72, where it said key measures, and we're talking about the JobZ program. And it says here that the proposal is estimated to maintain JobZ participation at approximately 67 businesses per year, averaging 15 new jobs and $1.5 million in new investment per project. And again, I'm trying to get at the cost to taxpayers for each of these new jobs. And that seems to be saying, and this can't be correct, so I guess I just need you to help me understand this better. That almost makes it sound like we're spending $100,000 per job for this program. So part of my question is to explain that statement to me. And then the second is, when we're saying we're spending this per job or new investment per project, are we spending this additional amount of money on each job per year in terms of tax credits? Because if you look at the top of that page and you look at the chart going forward, you see that it begins to cost us much more each year cumulatively as we bring new businesses online, but the tax credit's extending from year to year, so it's costing us cumulatively a lot more as this program goes along. And so are these costs per job costs that we're spending on a one-time basis when you're looking at how much we're spending per job or over the course of the whole program?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, Paul Moe has rejoined me. He's our expert on JobZ, and he'll try to answer your question.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, in 2004, we had 133 companies sign up under the JobZ program. 2005, it was 90-some. 2006, it's 57. We're seeing a dramatic decrease in the number of JobZ deals being signed up and participating, partly because the benefits are no longer 12 years. There's 8 years left of the program as it currently stands because it expires in 2015. What we've tried to do is estimate what kind of participation we might expect if everybody signing up going forward gets 10 years until it expires December 2015. This is an estimate to say, if there is benefits for 10 years, would we get 50 to 60 kind of companies signing up a year? That's an estimate. How much that costs is a variable, or the benefits of that is a variable depending upon the impact and scope of these projects. Many of these projects are smaller in scale in terms of their capital investment, in terms of the job creation. Some are 5 jobs or 10 jobs, and some are hundreds of jobs and multimillion-dollar investments. So to get an average, and maybe this was not the correct way to portray this in terms of an average, maybe we should have said we expect this participation to create in aggregate this kind of jobs at this kind of wages. I guess I'm hesitant to say exactly what the cost will be. I can tell from 2004 and 2005 projects, what the benefit is in terms of capital investment, what the benefit or the investment in capital private investment. I can tell what the job creation has been from those projects, and then also then backtrack and say, here's what we think that cost is. And I think I said earlier that was about $18 million for those 2 years. Roughly, that's about $5,000 of tax benefit per job, which is fairly consistent with other types of public assistance programs for business development in the past and other programs. We can make some comparisons for you on that. Maybe what I should do is go back and work with our folks in our analysis division to kind of get a more aggregate sense of what the participation rate might be, and an aggregate number of jobs and investment, and then what the cost or benefit of the taxes will be on that.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, well, I'm still not really feeling like I'm getting an answer to my question in terms of what this statement here says.
Let me see if I can decode it for you.
Okay.
I think what this says is that we expect 60 to 70 businesses to generate 15 new jobs each, which is around 1,000 jobs a year. Mm-hmm. And that they, in addition to creating 1,000 jobs, that each of those 60 to 70 jobs will create $1.5 million of capital investment. So let's say there are 60. That's about $90 million of additional capital that will in the long term go on tax rolls in local areas. If we say that it's 1,000 jobs and the cost in 2011 is $1,200, that's $1.2 million, that's $1,200 a job. If it lasts for 10 years, that's $12,000 a job, not $100,000. That's an estimated guess, because I would hope we'd get some mega deals. You know, we would attract a company to downtown Hibbing with 2,000 or 3,000 great-paying jobs, and maybe we will. But this, I think, is a conservative estimate, and it shows a cost about like I outlined.
You'd really get me on board if you did that. But
I'm working on it, Senator. I'm working on it.
I think, though, I'm just wondering, because Mr. Moe, what you said about the number of businesses that have declined over the last 3 years, I mean, have we gotten to a saturation point? Are the Job Z areas being filled in so there's no more? Is it just a matter of you can only recruit so many, and now you're to the point where you can't get any more? And I understand the 10-year thing to see if that's a carrot and if we get back up to where it was. But I think Senator Olson has a pretty good question as to the cost of these jobs, because this does look like $100,000 a job the way it's stated here.
I think, Mr. Chair,
and then you can answer.
Okay. Now that, just in light of your explanation, I think I was reading this to talk about investment of tax dollars, and I think what it's meant to say is investment of money generated into the community. Would that be?
That's correct.
Okay.
Private investment. I'm sorry.
Okay. So that was my misunderstanding. I thought it was talking about how many tax dollars we were having to invest to make this happen.
We should have added the word private there.
Okay.
I'll go ahead and answer my saturation question.
Mr. Chairman, hard one to answer in terms of participation. We have seen a decline to the extent that we attribute that to declining value of the program because it's diminishing as time goes on, or other reasons. I can remember, I think, in 2003 when there was discussion about the Job Z program, I think there was some pent-up demand, if you will, or pent-up interest in the program, and waited to sign up until after the law was passed in 2004. So maybe 133 was anomaly, and we're going to see a drop-off and level off at something less than that if we go forward with a 10-year program.
And I believe, Mr. Chairman and members, that's why our analysts are estimating that 60 to 70, that may be more the sustainable demand. That's still a lot of deals in greater Minnesota. And I remind those members, this is only available in areas outside the metropolitan area.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm on to a new subject, so are we done with Job Z?
Are you done, Senator Olson?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Great. Thanks. I have hopefully what are just a couple of quick questions. In the overview on the business and community development responsibility area, I thought I heard someone say, maybe Mr. Loftus said, particularly in the community development, there was some housing some housing initiatives or housing that was supported, and I didn't catch what that was, and and I haven't seen anything.
That was Mark Loftus, who said that, and Paul Moe, who has done that work over a long period of time, can answer the question, but it has to do with the small business development, or small community development grants.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, we have an allocation from HUD through our CDBG program. As the Commissioner said earlier, all of that really is allocated out in rural areas. Much of that work is for housing rehabilitation for low and moderate income families.
Okay, so those HUD dollars, those CDBG dollars, come through deed and are administered?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's correct, yes.
Okay. And only to non-entitlement communities.
Okay, okay. And Mr. Chair, so is that done in conjunction or coordination with MHFA, or why isn't that handled through MHFA?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, MHFA, to my understanding, gets another allocation of some HUD dollars for some different activity.
Okay. Well, I'd like to understand that piece better. So if there's some program materials or something that can be shipped over to my office, that would be great.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'd be happy to follow up with you on that.
Thank you. And then finally, on page 33, you know, this rundown of services provided. I never saw, all the different paragraphs that describe. I never saw a breakdown of how much we spend in each of those areas. Am I missing that, or is there something I can look at that would tell me? You know, it's the dislocated worker, workforce investment, job seeker, veterans programs,
so,
et cetera.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, you'd like a breakdown as to what we spend on dislocated workers, workforce investment, Title I-B,
yeah,
job seeker services?
Yeah, all those. All
we'll
those
put those together and get them to your office
pages.
In the next.
Thanks. Thank you.
We'll put that together.
I found out there's all kinds of little computer programs in the background of all these things that have all kinds of little numbers that we don't ever get to see. That if you want to see them, you can really see them, but you actually have to be very interested.
So you go on my own computer and
I don't know if
burrow deep
own.
Into
I
these documents.
Got, and I think you got to get it on Dave's if you want to know the truth.
Oh, Dave is
Dave. Dave is everything. Okay, any more questions of these gentlemen as long as they're here? Thank you very much. I actually think we did finish on time, but we started a little bit late because of the committee that was in before us. So good job, you guys. I just want the members to know that, and we'll be discussing what we end up doing eventually, I guess, but I just want the members who are left here to know, or anybody who might be still listening, that our next couple meetings will probably be just as boring as this one, but it's a matter of having to go through the numbers and take a look at everything, because I think, well, we're a budget committee, and we do have to make a budget up, and we do have to find out what is going on in the budget book, and I think it's important that we go through them, and you guys did a very good job of explaining it, so I appreciate that. And
thank you, Senator.
And so with that, if anybody has any questions of anybody from the agencies, you know who to contact now, and I'm sure they'll be happy to come to each individual senator's office and explain things. So that meeting adjourned.